Haunted Experiences with Michelle Belanger. That's just up next on Coast to Coast AM. Michelle, back to the Hitchcock-esque type story. Go ahead.
Yeah, Alfred Hitchcock had nothing on Whitethorn Woods that afternoon. It's one thing for me to perceive spirits because, you know, I can kind of go, well, it could all be in my head, but when animals react in ways that are deeply unusual, I really stand up and take notice. I personally find it very unsettling. After a weekend of a number of experiences from a wide variety of people, it was a function of my college, so a lot of college students there. The last of us were cleaning up, and it was two scenic cabins. It was a property that was left to the college on the Ohio Canal system. Very, very beautiful bucolic woods. Well, there's this point where, while cleaning up, there's a hush that falls over the woods. And anybody who's been in a really significant paranormal experience knows that moment where it feels like the air just tightens up. And you can feel almost like an electricity, like the world sort of holds its breath
right.
Collectively.
And a stillness.
A stillness and a silence. So we're out in the woods in, you know, North American hardwood forest, and suddenly there is no noise, there is no wind, there's just this collective moment of the world literally waiting for something. And we kind of, our nerves are a little raw from some of the crazier stuff that went on that weekend, and so we kind of look at one another going, what the heck's going on? And then the woods to the north of us, literally burst with blackbirds, crows, and a number of other species all mixed together, just a swarm of birds just come out of the woods. And, you know, okay, it was fall, so the birds were migrating. So a big flock, not an unusual thing. Their behavior was simply bizarre. These birds just poured out of the woods, and the far house that was across a gully and a little footbridge, they start landing on the roof. And when they land, the birds just fall silent. They're not calling or squawking or anything. They just sit there and stare at us, all of them, just staring straight in our direction. And they cover the roof until it is black with blackbirds, and there's just more and more of them pouring out of the woods. And literally, they just keep marching in a line. When they are on the ground, they do not fuss, they do not caw, they just stare at us as if to say, get the heck out. And the first guy who has the keys to the property beats feet. Like, he's like, guys, I'm going to be up at the gate, and if you're not there in 10 minutes, I'm gone. I'm sorry. I'm locking it up.
I'm out of there, right?
I have a really bad curiosity streak, so I was the last to leave. I mean, I wanted to see what would happen if they got to me. I mean, I wanted to see, there was a sense that there was something really big going to happen, and just the birds kept coming, and again, once they hit the ground, they were silent, and they just stared. Of course, my better half at the time presumed upon me to finally go before I had my eyes pecked out or something crazy happened,
yeah.
So I will never know. And it really does eat at me because I'm like, well, what could have happened? What would have happened? Because it's unusual at a haunting for a ghost or a spirit to be able to hurt someone. It takes a tremendous amount of energy for something to actually, like, lash out, you know, throw objects or leave marks on people. It's usually only really unusual and extreme hauntings and frequently not human spirits that are able to have that kind of force and effect. So I couldn't even imagine what was inspiring the birds to do this. It was so completely unusual for them and chilling because there was just an intelligence in all those eyes. I did not expect the silence and the attentive staring. And they were fearless. They just kept marching along the ground, covered the footbridge, and more of them just kept coming out.
Kept coming, more and more.
Yeah, more and more. And it was multiple species of birds. The only thing they had in common is they were all blackbirds. Crows, starlings, grackles, anything black, and creepy as heck.
Crows are scary looking. I don't know why, but they just are.
They're carrion eaters, and so we have associations with, you know, crows, ravens, all of those things with battlefields. Actually, a lot of cultures, a lot of mythologies. They are birds that kind of move between this world and the next world. They're in some mythologies, they are the psychopomps, you know, the guides of the dead. They move spirits back and forth. So we associate them with death on some sort of real visceral level.
Lots of paranormal shows out there right now, and Yeah, we have a lot of people who call this show who like to get into ghost hunting for fun, primarily, some for profit. Any recommendations?
Well, first, I think that anybody who gets into ghost hunting really needs first to know how to protect themselves. It's one thing to go wandering around a cemetery trying to hunt up a few ghosts, but a lot of people do not realize that even though attacks from spirits and physical attacks, especially, are very, very rare, a lot of hauntings are just energy. They're emotional imprints left in places. And whether we acknowledge whether we're psychic or not, people are sensitive to that, and they can unconsciously react to that. So if you're going ghost hunting, a lot of crews will know to bring batteries and flashlights, and they will concern themselves with physical well-being, but they need to protect themselves on the spiritual level. If you believe that ghosts exist, and you are specifically going to incite them, to try to go into their territory, you should know how to also protect yourself on that side. And that goes back to that idea of having firm boundaries, knowing that your belief, your intent, and your will helps to direct that, and doing things like shielding that ball of light around yourself, and knowing what it feels like when something is attacking you. A lot of spirits will take energy from people or will kind of emit negative emotions. You know, you start to pick it up and you'll mistake it for your own emotion if you are in an area where something is kind of doing this. And if you know how to shield, if you know how to shut that down and draw the boundary between what you are experiencing yourself and what is outside of you, what is acting on you, you have a better chance of maintaining a clear head, even if it gets really negative, even if it gets really scary.
Michelle, a friend of mine took her husband out this past weekend on his birthday to a haunted place in St. Louis. It's called the Lemp Mansion. Everybody in St. Louis knows that. It was owned by an old brewery family. They lived in this mansion next to their brewery. And three family members over time committed suicide there. So lots of folks say it's haunted. I've been in there, and it's kind of creepy. Anyway, they spent the night there. They had dinner somewhere else, and they picked up some very weird things happening. I mean, there's no doubt about it. When ghosts are there, they're there, and they're pretty darn scary for a lot of people. It's not a game, is it?
It shouldn't be approached as a game. It's like our conversation about the Ouija board. It's not a game. Anything on that side, it's real, and it can have a real impact on you. I think some people really want to believe, and they go into situations because they haven't had an experience, and they really desperately want something to happen that is significant enough that will make them believe, that they can't possibly deny it. From my own experiences, if you really set out to deny your experiences of the spirit realm, they are subtle enough that you can always, always rationalize it away and intellectualize it away. And I've watched people have an experience where literally something is getting thrown around the room, and give them a couple of days later and they've come up with an explanation that makes perfect sense to them because they just can't wrap their brains around it any other way. But if you are going purely for the experience, if you're going purely to have something scare the hell out of you so that you can believe, the thing you have to keep in mind is it is real. It does have an effect on you. And while many spirits are pretty benign, they're not going to do anything more than kind of, you know, give you the chills because there's something there. There are things that are negative, and sometimes they'll follow you home. If they find you to be far more interesting than their particular place that they're haunting, they may decide that they are going to take up residence where you live. And you need to know how to maintain those boundaries and how to keep yourself safe from that situation. You don't want to just blithely wander into it with no knowledge of how to protect yourself.
What do you think of the TV show Paranormal State?
I have a lot of fun working with it. I was friends with the kids who are the Paranormal Research Society, mm-hmm, before it became a show, before they were part of a show. Josh Light and Elfie Music were the two who got me involved. They do a convention every year called UNIFCON. And Ryan Buell, he's a Catholic and was a little skeptical. He's like, you're inviting a psychic vampire to the event? And then he met me. He was like, oh, Okay, which is sort of a response I get from a lot of people. I think people generally expect me to show up in a cape with fangs and doing some, I don't know, scenery-chewing goofiness, but I'm fairly normal and down-to-earth when it all comes down to it.
When you want to be, right?
When I want to be. As I said, music videos with a metal band aside.
And what was the name of that video again?
Shadow Dancer, and the band Shadow is Urn, U-R-N. And I've written some music with them. Actually, some of the members of Urn figure in haunting experiences and were with me at Whitethorn Woods when that really crazy stuff happened. Dominic St. Charles, who is the lead guitarist, has been a good friend for a very long time. And again, he's a nice Catholic boy. It's really funny. Heavy metal guitarist on the weekends, and then he goes and sings the Stations of the Cross at his local church during the week. Very, very nifty, diverse guy, and he has been around for some of the craziest stuff that's happened around me.
You aren't, you're pretty spiritual. You're not necessarily religious. Has that conflicted in any of your work?
I have not found a conflict. I believe mostly in faith itself, you know, that God's too big for one religion or name or anything, and if we have a sincere belief that there is something there. I mean, it's really hard to have had the near-death experiences that I did to not believe that there's something bigger out there, to not believe that we have a purpose and a reason to be here and that there's a grander scheme of things. But at the same time, it also made me think that that's far bigger than any words I could give it or any name or any face. Now, with Paranormal State, Ryan particularly works with demonic cases, with possession. There's a very controversial episode, and it's probably their most watched episode, called I Am Six, with a girl, Laura, who is, in the words of Lorraine Warren, under perfect possession. And they are actually working with the Catholic diocese to try to get in an actual Catholic exorcist because they have not been able to completely stave off the very alarming things that happened to this girl. I have personally witnessed two instances of what I could only describe as possession, of what I would only describe of as a demon. I don't think that you have to be Christian to recognize that there are some really dark spirits that really have it out for people. Like, they do not like us, and they go out of their way to mess with us. And again, being a student of many cultures, these beings, these spirits, are written about in the mythologies and religious systems of cultures that predate, you know, all of our modern religions, ancient Sumeria and Babylon. And I believe that there are some dark forces out there. And I think that one of the best things that we have to protect ourselves against them is our faith. And one of the things that really opens us up to them is our fear.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, because I think once you begin to become scared and you let your guard down, that's when you run into all kinds of problems. What do you think of possession, Michelle? People being possessed?
I think that some people who behave as if they are possessed may have mental issues, but I think that there is also a line where you have to wonder whether or not mental issues allowed someone to open that door for something to come in and prey on them. I have a student who is sensitive, and he was looking to get a job as a warden of a jail down in Louisiana in Baton Rouge. And he didn't tell, obviously, the people that he was working with that he's a spirit medium, and they're taking him through the area where they have got the criminally insane prisoners. And there's this one guy who is literally, like, barking mad. He's in the cell. He is shrieking and screaming and everything. And apparently this is, you know, normal behavior for him, because the guy is just like, you know, okay, yeah, this is one of our worst ones. And the guy stops, looks at my friend, and goes, "You can see me." And my friend is not mentioning to anyone that what he sees is the crazy man with a big spirit standing behind him. And the guy goes, "You can see me." And he fixates on it with my friend, just stares at him. "You can see me. Why can you see me?" And the other guard who's giving him the tour is like, "Dude, shut up.
Yeah,
I can see
yeah.
you too." And it looks at him and is like, "No, you can't see me. You can't really see me. He can see me." And he just, my friend just backs away slowly. He's like, "You guys wouldn't happen to have built this on a graveyard or anything, did you?" which apparently they had, some sort of Indian burial ground. And I know that that is a terrible cliche, and yet there seems to be some sort of overlap where certain sacred places probably shouldn't have things like prisons dumped on top of them. And he didn't go back for work the next day. He went back to his old job. He just didn't want to run the risk of having something follow him home.
Have you ever participated in an exorcism or anything like that?
I never thought that I would, and I usually have a standing policy with Paranormal State that their other psychic, Chip Coffey, he's welcome to the demonic cases, because I just kind of don't want to deal with it, partly because my religious background is different from Ryan's, and they usually use a Catholic approach, and I don't want to step on any toes by using a different approach. However, I had a friend who is pagan, who his wife contacted me, and yeah, it was a possession case. I was, again, skeptical. I tend to, my first initial response when people tell me about stuff that's going on is to wonder what else might be going on, to think about psychological explanations, and I really am, I need to experience it to believe it. Even now, it's kind of ridiculous for
sure.
Extraordinary things that I've had, there's still that skeptical streak. Sometimes I think it's actually...
It's healthy.
It is definitely healthy. I think it is absolutely healthy. But I also think in my case, it's a little part of my brain that if it's just in my head, it's safer that way. So sometimes I think it's also my personal thing. But I strongly, strongly recommend that people always question these experiences, always measure them, always test them, and go through like a reality checklist. You know, what am I expecting? How much am I projecting on this experience? Anyway, to go back to the possession, I wasn't sure what I would encounter, but when I was in Atlanta, Georgia, meeting with them, yes, there was, for lack of a better term, a demon, and I engaged in an exorcism in his particular faith, and he's a shaman and a pagan, and it was pretty hardcore, you know, voice changing, face changing, screaming in languages that he shouldn't have known, and languages in some cases I didn't recognize, and yeah, it was pretty hardcore.
Where do people get this work, Haunting Experiences?
Haunting Experiences, you can get it on Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, Borders, any major bookstore. I am lucky to be not only a prolific author, but an author with a really good publisher that gets me all sorts of places.
Great. What do you think of EVPs, electronic voice phenomenon?
I have heard some very compelling EVPs. I myself have no luck whatsoever getting them. I don't know if the ghosts just clam up around me or think that, you know, why should they bother with a recorder when they can just talk inside my head. But I do think that there is a tendency, especially because ghost hunting is such a popular sport now, that people will read a little bit too much into it. I've heard people who are sure that they had captured a ghost saying, "Get out!" And it just is like, do-do-do-do. And... You know, our minds are wired for pattern recognition, and it is perfectly human for us to take something that is vague and to interpret it and to project something onto it. So we need to be careful with photos, with orbs, with EVPs, with anything that is left up to a little of interpretation. I think it is very healthy to realize that there are also psychological factors that can play into our interpretation of that evidence.
What about hoaxes? Ever come across people who try to do that?
Oh, fortunately not on Paranormal State. They're actually really strict with the way they especially work with their mediums. I get flown out to a major city, and I know my hotel, but I don't know the site that we're actually filming at until about 2 hours before they need me, and I really like that. Actually, they had me go through one of the recent ones blindfolded, so that there was no chance of cold reading or being influenced by my environment, and I really... really love putting my abilities to the test that way.
Let's talk about vampires when we come right back, Michelle. Well, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to talk with Michelle Bélanger. When we come right back, though, we'll talk more about vampires on Coast to Coast AM. Let's talk about vampires in their own words, Michelle. Tell me about this story.
That is an anthology. As somebody who identifies as a member of the vampire community, there's a wide variety of people who identify with the vampire. And vampires are they've become this big image in pop culture. I mean, Twilight notwithstanding. And I've been able to tell my own story. But with that anthology, what I tried to do was open it up to a number of other people who also call themselves vampires, to have them tell their stories, to say, to explain why they identify as a vampire, why it's important, what their experiences are like.
And now when you say vampire, do you mean psychic vampire like you, or the vampires that we have been known to grow and understand on TV and movies?
Not at all like TV and movies, although there are some people and vampires in their own words who drink blood.
Okay.
Yep. And that was one of the reasons that I did the anthologies. I do not do that, and it is not something that I necessarily understand. But because of that shared word, vampire, people who drink blood as well as people who take vital energy get lumped under the same umbrella. And I wanted to allow them to speak and explain why it is they do what they do, what they think they accomplish with it, what their beliefs are, how it impacts their life, and who they are as people. So you can find out that, you know, there are vampire homicide detectives, and there are vampire PTA grandmothers, and there are vampire soccer moms, and there are vampire college professors and high school English teachers and nurses and some phlebotomists, although I have been assured repeatedly that none of the vampire phlebotomists I know take snacks at work.
Tell me about your interest in vampires beyond what has happened to you.
Well,
how did it start?
Obviously, when I kind of seized on the word and went, well, I guess I'm a psychic vampire, I came across that word through the writings of Dionne Fortune, who wrote a lot about psychic self-defense. In fact, she wrote probably like the classic work on it. But because of the word vampire, I wanted to understand more about the vampire in folklore and the vampire in fiction and this image it had become. But I also really became interested in seeing, was there a truth to the myth? Was there maybe a grain of truth about people like me or people like my friends who drink blood? You know, did the story of the vampire end up forming around real people who simply became mythologized? And so I started studying the beliefs in vampires worldwide and searching down everything from the Virkalakis to the, I'm going to mispronounce the Chinese, but the Hsui Kui, basically a blood-sucking demon or a chi-sucking demon, and trying to figure out what do Penanggalans and Langsuiers and Leon and She have in common. There's so many different beings in mythology all the world around and in folklore that are believed to take life from the living. What I found really is the folkloric vampire in many ways is simply the personification of humanity's fear for the dead. We are afraid on a primal level that the dead are going to come back and take from us that which they no longer have, which is our life, be it as life force or as blood. And, of course, nowhere more than in Eastern Europe has our Western image of the vampire been really colored by that idea of these revenants that rise from their corpses at night and come and, but first on earth as vampires send thy corpse shall from thy tomb be rent and ghastly haunt thy native place and suck the blood of all thy race. Thanks to Lord Byron.
Did Hollywood blow this out of proportion too?
Absolutely. I mean, you've got the 19th century, which is rife with vampires. And the vampires in the 19th century, they move from creatures of folklore to and from nonfiction representations of the kind of vampire scare that was going on in Eastern Europe, which kind of amounted to hill people and rednecks and country people who didn't understand about how death and disease and everything worked, digging up their relatives and beheading them and mutilating the corpses to prevent them from coming back. And all of this stuff was written about by, like, government officials and people who were sent to investigate this. But then it made this sort of bridge into fiction through the works of Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Lord Byron. Although Byron himself didn't end up publishing his vampire story. He's got a long poem called The Gior, but John William Polidori, his doctor, stole the story, republished it under Byron's name, and kind of started the whole phenomenon. And what he did was he took the vampire from being a folkloric boogeyman, and in his story, the vampire, Lord Riven, spelled Lord Ruthven for us Americans, is Byron. And he takes the vampire from being kind of more like a zombie, you know, the animated dead, to a person who preys upon others. who is very courtly about it, but is very cold. Really kind of almost a sexual predator. The Lord Riven feeds upon virgins exclusively. Now, Byron, of course, wasn't that particular himself, which is half the reason why Polidori was writing a character assassination by turning him into a vampire in the work. Later, Bram Stoker does about the same thing. His character, Dracula, is based on, it's an amalgamation of a couple of real living people, which in some ways makes it a more compelling figure. On one hand, you have Vlad Tepes, who was a historical warlord of Wallachia, Transylvania, and got the sobriquet Tepes because he had a particular fascination for using terror to inspire people, and he would impale people on stakes.
Yeah.
Kill them. Yeah. Pretty bloody, pretty terrible, but it certainly struck fear in both his people and in his enemies. He had a pretty peaceful reign when it all came down to it. I mean, people did not dare to really say boo. And he lived in a very bloody time with the Ottoman Turks infringing on their territory, so he kind of had to take pretty extreme tactics. One of the other things about Stoker's Dracula, though, is the other person Dracula is based off of is the actor Sir Henry Irving. And Stoker had a relationship with Irving, not a, you know, behind the scenes sort of thing. He was his stage manager, and Sir Henry Irving was renowned in his day as a Shakespearean actor, and people understood that Irving had what they called a mesmeric personality or animal magnetism. They believed at the time that he had the ability to use his personal charisma, to use his energy, to literally reach out to people in the audience. And women would swoon in the aisles at his performances. Stoker himself swooned at one of the dramatic readings that Irving did, that Irving directed most of his stage presence at Stoker, and he felt overwhelmed. Stoker belonged to a circle of people who studied stuff like that, who believed in psychic vampires. Dionne Fortune was the inheritor of this tradition. She was one of the early students of these people. And there is ample evidence to suggest that Stoker made Irving a vampire because he believed on a metaphysical level, on an energetic level, he was.
And gave it that romantic twist, too.
Yep, and gave it the romantic twist. And now we have Twilight.
And here we are now.
And there is, in the fictionalized and in the cinematic vampire, an undeniable undercurrent of sexual tension, particularly forbidden sexuality. Polidori's vampire, Lord Ruthven, there's a homosexual undercurrent in it. In Joseph Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla, there is a lesbian element to it. Even Samuel Taylor Coleridge in his poem Christabel, he's got... There is something about transgressive sexuality and the vampire and dominance and submission, that kind of predator and prey, but taken to the bedroom, that really, I think, keeps audiences on the edge of their seat and panting for more, because it's nothing that you'd want in a real relationship, and yet it's somehow strangely compelling on screen. I mean, think about Twilight, where you've got this guy basically stalking a girl. I mean, he's 100 plus years old. She's 17.
And there's nothing she can do about it.
Yeah, and I mean, he sneaks into her room at night and watches her while she sleeps. That's a little disturbing, and yet everybody's reading this, and it's the most romantic thing they've ever read.
And they want her to get bitten by him.
Yeah, and there is, in that aspect of the vampire, with the fangs and the penetration of the skin of the neck and the fluid exchange, really an unabashed sexual metaphor.
Yeah, I would agree. But now, turning this to the psychic vampire, totally different then, isn't
totally
it?
Totally different. The only thing in common, and most of us kind of complain about the word, the only thing in common is in the English language we have a word for a being that takes life from others, and that word is vampire, and we don't have a better word for it. The word psychic vampire was in fairly common usage by the end of the 1800s. You see it in some works in the middle of the 1800s. I do not know who coined it, but it is used to describe people like me. It is used most commonly in that era to describe people who prey upon others without their permission. Most of the books before my Psychic Vampire Codex, most of the books that treated people and presented the idea of psychic vampirism, presented it in terms of predators, people who either unconsciously would prey upon others or the rare few people who are aware of what they're doing and who like the power trip of taking energy from people without their permission.
And this feeling that you get when you get this energy, is it feel like it runs through your veins? What's it like?
It's sort of a full-body tingle, warm, rushing. I feel it sort of in the center of my chest. And it is a rush if it's done properly. For the person who it is taken from, if it is taken without their permission, it is a lot more uncomfortable. You can end up with headaches, nausea, and it feels very invasive. I mean, rightly so, because someone is invading your person to take something essential from you. If it is consensual, it's more of a sharing. And mostly what people report is just this overwhelming sense of relaxation, that kind of like really sleepy, I want to curl up with my favorite blanket sensation.
Yeah.
And they will sleep harder the first night, like, you know, 10 hours, 12 hours is not uncommon. But one of the things, again, if it is consensual, that seems to be a side effect, and a good one, is to have something taken away in a healthy system that naturally replenishes it. The old and stagnant stuff is what's taken away, and then the body naturally replenishes itself, usually after a night of sleep. So for the next week or two, the person who's had this taken away feels clearer, more focused, and healthier, because all of the stuff that would ordinarily have gotten like stagnant and gunked up has been taken away by the vampire. The psychic vampire, their system knows you process it and you can clear it out. So if it's used properly, it's something that can really facilitate healthy energy for people, because the healthiest thing about our vital energy is it needs to flow. And it is almost like, it is literally almost like the energetic equivalent of blood. It goes through us. I feel that probably the best model of the energy body is a marriage of the Hindu idea of the chakras and the Qigong meridians, where you have these channels that move through the body. And if you hold the map of the meridians over Gray's Anatomy and you look at all of the nerves and all of the circulatory system, you find that all of the major energy channels are almost right on top of all of the major nerves and all of the major arteries and veins. They are just this side of, they're almost the energetic reflections of our nerves and the energy that runs through those nerves and our veins and the vitality that runs through those veins.
Michelle, I don't see you as a person who would empty a room, yet I've witnessed people, and I don't think they're the kind of psychic vampires you are, for example. I've witnessed them empty a room. People leave. They're exhausted. They want to run away from this guy. And I've seen this happen time and time again. What is that?
What they are doing is they are not giving anything back. They are only taking. First of all,
and sometimes they don't even know they're taking.
Yes. A lot of unconscious psychic vampires, what they end up doing instinctively is they take as efficiently as possible. And there are two main ways to do that. Energy increases the emotional output that people have, like a heightened energy. Think of people at a ball game or at a concert. There's just all this energy that they spit out when they're really excited, when they're really focused on something, when they're in a heightened emotional state. So an unconscious psychic vampire naturally will try to elicit a strong emotional response from people, either that really dominating person that, you know, you might run into at work who gets up into your face and pushes all of your buttons to get an angry response. And when you're done with that confrontation with them, you feel drained, you feel violated, more so than you would having an ordinary argument with someone who isn't also taking your energy while they are getting up in your space and up in your face. And the other ones are the ones that literally suck the life out of you with the, oh, poor me, and pay attention to my problems, and just, you know, whine. And they always have more problems, and could you just give them a little bit more attention?
A few years ago, I'm giving a speech in Las Vegas. My producer, Tom, is here with us. And when it's done, he says, hey, let's play a little blackjack. So, you know, I say, all right, sure, we've got a couple bucks on us. Let's sit down and play. We happen to sit at a table, which I've never seen before. It's a blackjack table where you can also put a dollar next to your bet. And they've got a wheel, like the Wheel of Fortune.
Oh, neat.
And if you get a blackjack and you have a dollar in that circle, you get to spin the wheel and you win the odds based on the money you put down. So it's 10 to 1, 21. But the highest is 1,000 to 1.
Yep.
So we're playing. There's me. There's some other guy in between us. And then there's Tom on this guy's left. We don't know who this other guy is. But we're all playing blackjack. I happen to hit a blackjack and I had a dollar on one of these circles. So that means we get a spin. So I look over to Tom and I said, let's concentrate on the 1,000 odds, okay? And he'll spin it and we'll let our energy take this wheel right to that thing. And Tom says, sure, we'll do that. And the guy in the middle says, nah, it's not going to work. I'm not doing it. Now, we don't even know him, but he's already killing our energy, right? So the guy spins the wheel and I goes, it's coming up to the 1,000. Tom's concentrating. I'm concentrating. And this guy's going, eh, it's not going to happen. One click away, Michelle, from 1,000. One click away, it didn't happen. We were both convinced he was the one who killed us.
One of the things that I wanted to make was the Twin Towers, the Ground Zero thing, is we affect the world of energy just as much as it affects us. And we affect it through our intent and our belief. We shape that world as much as it affects us. And yeah, our belief, even if it's disbelief, can have an impact on those things.
Yep. You have to believe or it's not going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, really honestly believe. One of the approaches that I use, because again, I've got that mile-wide skeptical streak, is I allow myself in that moment to not have any doubt that this is going to be and that it is going to work. I just allow myself to commit to what it is I'm trying to do, being it opening myself up to the perception of spirits in a house or healing someone with energy. And I leave the doubts for afterwards. I allow myself to pick it apart as much as I want to or put it to the test or analyze it or anything because, I mean, we're human with our big brains. We like to pick things apart a lot. And it's healthy to do so. It's healthy to ask, okay, why did that really work? But in the moment, if you really want it to work, you have to commit yourself to that belief 100%
absolutely.
Without doubt.
I think Barack Obama used that. There were a lot of people who didn't think he'd win the nomination and then the presidency. I would guess Hillary was probably one of those. but I think he had a belief system, a very strong one, and that helped carry him and propel him to where he is today.
I think he very consciously shaped his path for winning that. He looked at his goal, and he didn't think that he was going to lose it. He was like, we are going to make change. I am going to make change. I will be the change I want to see in the world.
And he did it, indeed. Well, stick with us. When we come back, we're going to take phone calls with you, Michelle. Michelle's websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now, or works, and there are many. Include, of course, haunting experiences, vampires in their own words, the Psychic Vampire Codex. A lot of this is available on Amazon.com, by the way. We'll be right back.